8 Red Cross workers were kidnapped last week in the Democratic Republic of Congo by members of the armed Maimai Yakutumba militia. The hostages include 7 Congolese and 1 Swiss national. The International Committee of the Red Cross has been one of the few foreign aid organizations remaining in the Congo over decades of conflict. 6 staff members of the ICRC were murdered in 2002. Meanwhile, a Spanish doctor who was kidnapped while on vacation in the Congo was recently released after 2 weeks in captivity. Fresh violence has broken out in the Congo in recent months, resulting in thousands of people being displaced. The Congolese government is headed by Joseph Kabila, who came to power through the much-touted elections in 2006, which was supposed to herald a new era in the war-torn region. Kabila has faced accusations of illegitimately centralizing the government, abusing power, and running violent militias. He's also called for an end to the United Nations mission, MONUC, by 2011, ahead of the general elections. However, rights groups point out that the country relies on UN troops for the protection of women and internally displaced people. Last Friday, over a dozen rebel groups announced a new coalition in opposition to Kabila's presidency. My guest is Louise Arbour. She's the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group. She's currently in Los Angeles and now joins me in studio. So, as I said, the latest news coming out of the Congo is the kidnapping of these 8 Red Cross workers by one of the militias in the Congo. Has violence in the Congo gone up dramatically in recent years, or has there been a sort of continuing level of violence since Kabila's presidency?
Well, I think there's been, first of all, there's chronic, absolutely chronic violence in the east of the Congo. And then it has its acute moments. It has peaks, but basically it has never been fully eradicated. The FARDC, which are the armed forces of the Congo, are extremely unruly and I think clearly have been themselves responsible for all kinds of abuses on civilian populations, starting with things like looting and getting food because they're either not paid or not fed. So you can imagine if that's the case with the National Armed Forces, what it's like with all these various militia groups. There has been in recently an agreement between President Kagame of Rwanda and President Kabila of the Congo, and this was expected to be a real breakthrough in the decrease of the level of violence in the DRC, but we have yet, I think, to be able to see that this has been completely eradicated.
So there is an ongoing international discussion around the UN mission ending by 2011 ahead of the general elections, but a lot of organizations as well as governments think that it's a terrible idea for the UN to withdraw its forces from the Congo. What role does the UN currently play, and do you think it's a bad idea for the UN to withdraw too?
Well, I think there will have to be. The UN has been there for a very long time. It's one of the largest UN missions with close to 20,000 troops and a very, very big civilian component as well. But it seems to me it's not particularly helpful to talk about dates for exit and withdrawal. What's important is to articulate what remains to be accomplished with an international presence, including military presence, and I would have thought that there are two big issues essentially. One is this question of security in the East, security sector reform. This requires, I think, the continuation of the presence of MONUC, of the UN mission. The second aspect, which tends to be obscured by all the visibility that insecurity brings, is the whole question of governance. I mean, President Kabila was elected through a free and fair democratic process with a very impressive democratic agenda, including, you know, putting in place good governance, serious institutions.
It was supposed to be the beginning of a new era for
totally.
Congo.
Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, to put it on the most optimistic way, totally stalled. It has made virtually no progress. There was an entire decentralization initiative that had to take place so that Kinshasa is not, it's a huge country. It needs physical infrastructure, roads, and so on, but it also needs governance infrastructure. None of this has really started to happen. Local elections were supposed to take place. That's already in default. And now we're going to move towards presidential and general elections, which definitely will require, first of all, international financial support, and surely, I think, international sort of secure environment support.
And so does the United Nations sort of attempt to keep the peace between the population and some of these armed militias, or are they meant to, intervene only when absolutely necessary?
Well, I think the mandate is often articulated. That's part of the problem in these in a lot of these United Nations mandates. Sometimes the mandate is articulated in very vague, not particularly helpful terms, such as protection of civilians. Well, how exactly does this translate into military mandate? I think can lead to a considerable amount of uncertainty. There was a time where MONUC, the peacekeeping mission, was actually actively supporting military activities by the FARDC, the armed forces, going after these rebel groups. This was very problematic because the methodology of warfare was not very appropriate, I think, for international forces to support, such as attacks on militias, which were then immediately followed by retaliation on civilian populations. And so you don't want United Nations peacekeeper to be instrumentalized in the sense as becoming virtually accomplices of terrible exactions perpetrated on civilians. So I think the mandate has to be articulated with greater precision. And at the same time, I think the disagreement between Kagame and Kabila, which is directed towards this particular militia group, which is a remnant, you know, sort of the leftover of the Rwandan genocide era, a lot of that can be done, I think, through political engagement between the two leaders.
Now, let's talk about Kabila's presidency. As we mentioned, he came in with a lot of promise. What went wrong and why?
Well, I think what you see, and it's not unique to the Congo, I think we unfortunately see these patterns elsewhere, is that we support, when I say we, the international community in all its incarnations, on bilateral donors and the UN and multilateral initiatives and so on, support a very strong executive. When they look at democratic governance, we support elections that then produce, in these presidential regimes, a very strong figurehead government executive. We produce a kind of paper parliament or legislative branch, which is not particularly empowered. And then there's a virtually non-existence in the judicial branch, the press, the media, all civil society actors that are the hearts and lungs of democracies as we know them. So it's a system that on paper looks like democratic governance, but in reality, all the emphasis goes to supporting the strongman model. And then we are surprised that this concentration of power leads to authoritarianism and not exactly to the fostering of opening up, you know, a space for opposition parties, for minority groups to find their voice. And so we see a hardening of authoritarian models.
I'm speaking with Louise Arbour. She's the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group. They've just put out a report called Congo, a Stalled Democratic Agenda, and she's here in Los Angeles currently. So let's talk about why or how Kabila has consolidated power. And you talked about the decentralization that was supposed to happen after the elections as part of the democratic process unfolding when the elections took place. What are some of the things he's doing right now to centralize that power, to take it back? I understand he's looking at amending the constitution and basically trying to centralize power in his government and in his presidency.
Well, I think that's the big fear now, that and maybe sometimes we put in place or we support constitutional models that are just too ambitious. I mean, to think that in a 4 or 5 year term, a country like the Democratic Republic of Congo can actually implement through legislation and actual operational models the kind of decentralization that was contemplated in the Constitution. It was the idea of creating, I think, 26 provinces. That means putting in place administrative and political local structures, with the devolution of money that would go to these governments. First of all, there's no national leader in reality who's going to have a lot of appetite for surrendering that much power to local agents unless they're all very loyal to him. So in a sense, it's not a great surprise. What we see now, though, is that there's already a default of the constitutional requirements of decentralization and putting in place all this kind of governance structure. The reality is, for most people, this is what matters. It's the capacity to have local governance so that they have access to their leaders, an administration that can deliver basic services, justice, and so on. None of that has happened yet.
And so what you just mentioned, are those among the recommendations that the International Crisis Group makes on how Congo can move forward, local governance, et cetera?
Very much so. And the danger, of course, is to keep tolerating constitutional default to a point where constitutional reform becomes inevitable with the opening up of the possibility of legitimizing this concentration of power in the hands of the president, right? The paper model was highly desirable, but when you see it fall into default, the danger is that the governance structure will not resemble anything like a democratic model. Down the road, we're talking, a few years down the road. So all this investment in trying to give Congolese the ability to be self-governed and so on will have been completely wasted unless we really start paying attention and unless the including the donor community supports that kind of effort.
And you mentioned the donor community, and yes, a lot of investment has happened from the international community. Just in terms of dollars, money, aid money has actually flowed in quite large numbers to the Congo, even though when New York Times writer Nicholas Kristof bemoans how little attention is paid to the Congo, to some extent that's true. But on the other hand, money has flown flown into the Congo. What has happened to much of that money? Has it sort of disappeared down a sinkhole? And do you cite corruption as one major issue?
Well, I think, frankly, a lot of it goes to the day-to-day delivery. It's kind of a humanitarian effort, day-to-day delivery of basic services that in another environment would be delivered by state authorities if they had any kind of capacity. And there's a lot of talk of capacity building, which also means, training in the judicial sector or the medical sector. But at the end of the day, if there's not a real political engagement on the part of the government, all of that money goes to basic service deliveries where the infrastructure is so non-existent. That you can do, say, in the education field. You could go to the Congo and open a school. You could do it in the health field as well. And God knows the needs are tremendous. I've been many, many times. You can go and open a clinic, but you can't go and open a courtroom. Right? You can't open. There are some sectors that are fundamental to the security and prosperity of a country that can only be delivered by governments. And that's where I think it's extremely difficult to see progress being made. The rest, a lot of it is highly desirable, but it's band-aids and will have to be renewed constantly.
Now, some have brought up the one major problem with the Congo, and that really affects what happens in the Congo as a sort of dual a blessing and curse of Congo, which is its mineral resources. Congo is one of the most mineral-rich countries in Africa and in the world, and a lot of the minerals found in Congo and mined in Congo are used in our day-to-day, technological toys, our computers, our iPods, etc. How much of the politics and the political conflict in the Congo centers around the international community's appetite for these minerals?
Well, I think it's endemic in the Congo, but it's not unique to the Congo. I mean, in countries that we don't hear a lot about, like Guinea, for instance, you have exactly the same kind of potential source of exploitation by actors that fall totally under the radar screen. So not only is it a terrible source of corruption and dilapidation of natural resources that belong to the people of these countries, but it's also the erosion of a potential tax base. I mean, if these were exploited adequately, what you would have is the capacity then to generate income for the states as opposed to foreign aid becoming and being, in many of these cases, the major budgetary line for support of government activities. So it's illegal in many, many instances. All these mining activities, which are highly lucrative, are the source of insecurity because it's all done illegally. Illegal armed groups fight for control of access to the territories in which they could do that. So you see the whole chain of sort of black market economy on a very large scale, completely eradicating, again, the state capacity.
And do those fund the armed militias, the black markets?
Oh, yes. I think to a large extent, this is all self-sustaining. I mean, there's money. A lot of them are actually, the militias are themselves the exploiters of some of these of this mining activities and are, you know, are part of the supply chain. Mm-hmm. At other times, they will provide security for other actors.
So then is there a responsibility that transnational corporations and other foreign companies bear for some of what's happening in the Congo?
Well, I'm sure, yeah, I'm sure to a large extent that is true. Now, whether, you know, at the end of the day, the question, I think, is the necessity to build governance infrastructure. I mean, this has to be overseen by a public sector infrastructure.
Right. But
this environment, yeah, is very conducive to illegal activities by private actors.
And good governance might not be as lucrative, sadly, for some people who benefit from the current mineral mining. I'm speaking with Louise Arbour, President and CEO of the International Crisis Group. So finally, what can the international community do to foster some of the things that your organization recommends need to happen, the decentralization, having the proper governance, dealing with things like corruption? Should we do it through, does it have to happen through the UN or through aid organizations or through bilateral talks?
No, I think there's a combination. I mean, the center of gravity, I think, is very much in the United Nations. I mean, as I said, MONUC, the UN mission in the Congo, is one of the largest peacekeeping and peacebuilding enterprise in the United Nations. Its mandate is housed and managed in the Security Council of the UN. So there has to be that level of very, very strong international engagement to take on, I think, a presidency that may be very reluctant to embrace the kind of change that is necessary for the country to be able to survive on its own. But I think bilateral donors also have a responsibility to some extent to coordinate their efforts as opposed to use international aid mostly in the pursuit of their own national interest and therefore either duplicating efforts that are not particularly useful, neglecting entire sectors. So I think we need something that is much more strongly coordinated and that understands the value of the rule of law, governance, institution building. It's less easy to sell to public opinion. It's not very tangible. It's not as visible as building a hospital. But in the long run, it's without that, I think there's not much hope that we'll do anything but humanitarian assistance.
What do you think will happen in the elections next year?
At this stage, it's very hard to tell. It's very hard to tell whether all this will take place on schedule. As I said, the local elections have already been delayed in the Congo. The president has talked about asking for a withdrawal of international troops ahead of the elections. What kind of climate will that produce for the country? Where's the money going to come from to support a very expensive electoral infrastructure? I think all this is still ahead of us.
And tell us a little bit about the International Crisis Group and briefly what your organization actually does in the Congo.
Well, this organization was created about 15 years ago, mostly as a result of the war in the former Yugoslavia, Rwanda, where several people, including a few American diplomats, came to the conclusion that there has to be a role for civil society actors to play in international peace and security. You couldn't leave it all to governments, which just play out their conflicting national interests. So the organization is now, we're present in about 40 countries. We are field-based. So our belief is that first you have to get the local politics right before you can start pontificating about how to move forward. We don't have great conflict resolution ideologies. We're just out there in the field. We work on all the big tickets, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Sudan, Congo, Somalia. But we also work on potential conflict zones that are not attracting a lot of public interest, like Guinea-Bissau, Madagascar, Papua, sort of Nepal, things that are not on the radar screen, but where we think we can make a difference by speaking up and with prescriptions and engaging political actors internationally. So we're essentially a conflict prevention, conflict resolution organization working very much on the ground.
And your website is?
It's crisisgroup.org.
Crisisgroup.org is the website of the International Crisis Group. My guest is Louise Arbour, President and CEO of the ICG. Louise, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.